Welcome to the first ever Tech Southwest podcast. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Fayaza Khan. I'm here with Robert Hillier. And we're in Bristol today. We're at the Bristol Tech Fest talking about what makes this city so interesting for the tech sector.
So a bit about Bristol. It's a city of 500,000 people, isn't it? Which makes it the biggest city in the southwest. It was a former wealthy trading port back in the day, 100 plus years ago. Fell on hard times, I think it's fair enough to say. But in recent years, it's reinvented itself as a pretty cool, hip, happening place. And it's been reinventing itself, really, as one of the world's hottest tech innovation hubs. And that's why we're here.
And I'm also here for the food.
Well, I'm here for the tech. So on with the show.
This is the Tectonic Podcast, in collaboration with Stephen Scone.
We're at the engine shed, what was once the home of cutting-edge railway technology under Isambard Kingdom Brunel, but now welcomes 30,000 people every year for meetings, events, and of course, to work on their own innovative projects in this amazing space.
There are 42 events at the festival, from building house in Mars to tech challenges around coding and gaming, health technology, agri-tech, digital disruption, robotics, startup advice, e-health, education, economics.
Yeah, okay, so we can't bring you all of that, but what we will do is give you a taste of the festival with some great guests. Sophia, as I set the scene, where are we right now?
Well, we're with Nick Sturge in the old Station Master's room.
The old Station Master's office, yes, just to make sure that we know we're in the engine shed.
Nick's responsible for engine shed, but you wear quite a few hats. You're regional director of the Institute of Directors. You oversee Set Squared. Why have you done this?
I sometimes ask myself the same question. So I've been running the Set Squared Centre Business Incubator, currently ranked world's number one university ranked business incubator since 2006. It's been going since 2002. I have somebody who runs that for me now, Monica Radcliffe, who's fantastic. We support within the incubator early stage, high tech, high growth businesses, wherever they've come from. Some come from the university academic base, some come from student base, but mostly from the local community. And we produce some really fantastic businesses. 5-6 years ago, we created Engine Shed physically as a new home for the Setsworth Incubator. So Setsworth is the anchor tenant of Engine Shed. But it was an opportunity to find a way to make a bigger impact in the city. So what we created with Engine Shed was a physical building, 30,000 square feet. We house Setsworth Incubator, we've got meeting rooms, we've got other organisations here. So we have a mixture of people regularly using the space who are academics, entrepreneurs, business leaders, thinkers, policymakers, etc. Now, all those things together give us two things. And I should say this is a collaboration between the City Council and the University, which is a feat in itself. We generate cash, but also intelligence. So we have a really, really good feel about what's going on in the city. So we use the cash that we generate to identify projects, experiments that we can do with a mission to drive sustainable, inclusive economic growth. So we've done some stuff to stimulate the investment environment, to increase the flow of capital. We've done some work to stimulate the property market and try and get our very traditional property real estate sector to adapt to the modern ways of working and so on. Well, as much by educating the agents, encouraging workspace operators to come to the city. So Runway East have come to the city, the first place out of London. We help them, not only encourage them to come here, but also to help them engage with the ecosystem. Now, that's interesting because they're kind of a competitor, but the Bristol spirit, you see, is we have a common goal here, which is sustainable, inclusive economic growth, and we all have to play a part in that. But then we also do an awful lot of work with kids, young people, and adults who aren't currently as engaged as they could be in their own future, let alone the future of our city. So we have a very, very diverse population. For example, 91 different languages spoken in the city. We need those kids in our workforce, not just because the tech sector is underrepresented in terms of women and ethnic diversity, but actually we need the talent, we need that diversity, because that enriches businesses' creativity. Yeah. If we want to make products for the global marketplace, we need different perspectives driving those. We've hosted about 5,000 young people using the space. We tell them, A, this is a workspace, people work here. They go,
Is this like school excursions or something?
Yeah. And we also tell them that you don't need to go to university to get into some of these exciting things. And what that, those three messages seem to unlock something within these kids. And what we also learned that we need to do this with teachers as well. So we now host inset days for free, and we've just been, the latest experiment has been running teacher work experience, placing a teacher, secondary school teacher, into an exciting small startup. So that not only does the company learn about the challenges that teachers have, but also gives an exposure of really what the modern workplace looks like, and what jobs actually look like, and the naming of jobs. You know, I mean, full stack developer, scrum lead, sprint master. What does that mean to somebody who's come out of teacher training college 20 years ago? The beauty of what we've been done, and it's been an absolute ball, has been to be able to experiment with some of those things.
It sounds a bit like a mindset change as well. You're changing teachers' minds, but also students, because I think when you're in school and you're really young, one of the things you're always told is, okay, you go to school and then you maybe go to sixth form college and then you go to university. Yeah. But you're saying, actually, you don't have to do any of that.
Yeah, so it is a mindset change. And we recognise that all we could do was sow the seeds. You know, you have a 10-year-old in for half a day, and you can sow some seeds, and you hope that that's going to stick. So then, the next thing, and then this comes on to the technology festival. So man and woman on the street do not see what's going on. That's partly because we're just a very industrious kind of psyche in the city. The thinking behind the CRISPR Technology Festival was, A, we've got a whole load of exciting stuff happening in tech, and Bristol is very well known for its festivals, its kite festivals, its vegan festivals, its jazz festival, festival of ideas and so on. But there wasn't something that actually celebrated the tech sector. So that was an obvious. But actually deeper than that, how can we really raise the bar, raise the game, raise the profile of the city's cluster nationally, internationally, but also locally?
What do you think it is about Bristol as a city that's lent itself to incubating and being the centre of the tech industry in this way, in a way that no other city in the UK seems to have done?
Ethics, I think. I'm biased. My family have been in the city for nearly 400 years. Historically, my ancestors were all about social justice. But there is a sense of ethical behaviour here. And you could put it down to a number of things. I think it's related to our checkered history in terms of trade and the slave trade in the city. We're still hand-wringing, you know, there's anxiety in the city about how we remember or forget or shut out that history and the wealth that's generated in the city. But I think that has led to a way of we try and do a job well, and we're in it for the long term. We also have to remember that the city's been trading as a port for 1,000 years, so we've always been a trading culture. And we have got a very diverse city, and that does lead to innovation, that does lead to a resilience in the city of multiple world-class sectors. And so the potential for innovation, all the ingredients of innovation have been there. And what we've done with Engine Shared and SetSquared is to kind of top up some of those bits that haven't been so strong, like the investment piece. But there's just a strong work ethic. There's an interesting dimension in the city, I think, of a kind of a healthy cynicism and also creative tension. So the diversity of the sectors, and also it's quite a political city, and so you get tensions, people get anxious about things, which is good, because that leads to creativity. Banksy would not have been successful if he hadn't had things he could put his finger on as tension points. So that does lead to creativity, as much as some of those things are challenging. But we've got a demographic in the city which is changing rapidly, and we need to catch up with that change. And that's about being inclusive employers, inclusive city, and we've got to tackle that.
How difficult is that for the tech sector, to be inclusive, well, diverse? I mean, is that a difficult thing to do, because you have to recruit people who actually want to be in that sector.
You do, and I think part of the challenge, what is built into what I described is a certain amount of tradition. You know, historically, tech companies, and you know, if you think that a lot of the history in the tech sector here is about semiconductors, embedded software, kind of complex deep tech, they're typically engineering graduates. And when I did my engineering degree at university, it was 10% female. That probably hasn't changed much now. So it's as much about getting employers who are trying to accelerate like this. And the challenge with entrepreneurs, of course, is they've typically not got any business training. So you do the technology bit and you do the business bit on the side. Oh, and I need another person, so I'll go and hire somebody who probably looks like me. Mm. And the pool is rich with white male engineering graduates.
Yeah.
So it's as much about changing the pathway, the educational pathways, and that's why we've been doing this work around teacher work experience and student work experience and getting youngsters to think there is something for them.
So do you think that's where the issue is? That's where the gap is? It's the pathways, it's the education pathway to the tech sector, and that's what's stopping women and ethnic minorities and, well, younger people coming into tech?
I think it's part of it, and of course we've got to get over this barrier. If you go and look at a job or workplace and there's no one who looks like you, you're as likely to walk away. And I think that's started to change. We are not short of goodwill in the city to make positive change. It's what are the tools to do it. And so going back to the Technology Festival, a real strand, and I'm not saying we've done it perfectly, is to try and demonstrate that there are things for everybody in the city. We're doing stuff for young people and families, some for the real techies, some for the non-tech business leaders, and so on. Some, you know, really quite esoteric topics at some of the events. There's a richness there, and of course it's that statement of richness. It's like, ah, wow, that's the message we want to get across.
Have you got time for one more quick question?
Yeah.
The word sustainability runs through the mission statement and at the heart of the festival as well. What does that mean in this context?
Okay, so sustainability is an important word that we use a lot, and it really does mean how do we make sure things sustain positively. So there is an environmental aspect of that, but there's also about business resilience and sustainability. So we don't want, as an economy, this is my view, as an economy, national economy, we don't want to put all our effort into creating lots of startups that fizz out. That doesn't help anybody, actually. What we want is companies that sustain. We also don't want this kind of chasing of the valuation that creates these bubbles that also then fall hard. What we want and what we see in the city is good, solid growth. So that creates solid employment, which of course feeds the inclusion piece because you've got more solid employment opportunities. So we're interested in sustainability because the environmental piece is that businesses understand the benefits, not only of inclusion, but also environmental impact. They'll probably make their businesses more sustainable, partly from a cost base, but also actually if we want to recruit younger people, social value, environmental impact is a higher currency than it has been before. Mm.
So does that mean you do have to change the way you think about the valuation of a company in terms of its social capital, its environmental and impact, not just the intrinsic money value of that business?
I agree, but I think my point is that these things don't need to be a compromise. So you might have heard of B Corps, where people, profit, planet are built, baked into the constitution of the organisation. Bristol has a disproportionate number of B Corps in the city than others. There's a reason for that.
Talking tech in the Southwest.
So I don't know about you, but when we asked Nick about what it is that makes Bristol special, I thought he might talk about the size of the city or its proximity to London or the presence of the university. I didn't expect him to say its ethical heart.
Yeah, I found that really interesting, and I think it's quite nice, actually. And his enthusiasm for Bristol is quite infectious in some ways, because it really makes it seem like the kind of city that wants to do better and constantly wants to be, well, sustainable and inclusive and equal for everyone.
And so he feels that companies who are willing to measure their value, not just in their bank balances, but their social value, their ability to tackle climate change, their ability to work with
more disadvantaged communities. And it quite clearly says that's why it's working here, in a way that it doesn't. You know, I suppose other cities would also claim to have that. Maybe it's a bit of a combination of all of those factors which has come together.
Actually, you're right, because that's something that Zara Nanu talked about as well. Now, she's the CEO of Gap Square, and she also talked about how ethics plays such a huge part now in how companies want to run.
We're hearing from her a bit later.
But for now, we'll go to Richard Norton, or Norts, as he likes to be called. He's from Tiny Giant. He's the co-founder, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, we ended up talking about everything under the sun, including his own near career as a successful pop musician, and then his time in Australia and the production of AI cupcakes.
In collaboration with Stephen Scone.
We knew kind of what we wanted to do, but didn't know if you could do it. And again, we've always had interest in a lot of emerging tech. So it's not just about machine learning. You can apply lots of that stuff that you said off the mic beforehand. All machine learning is in all sorts of places, in the choices you get served on Amazon, on the shows that come up on your feed on Netflix, right? It's constantly looking at patterns to see what works for you. But equally, to apply it in a creative way. So what's an easy way to use it? So you take a recurrent neural network, which is very good at taking a database of text, and thought, right, let's feed it a load of recipes or something. What's easy to make? Oh, cupcakes. People love cupcakes, don't they? Right? So we basically just scraped hundreds and hundreds of cupcake recipes, trained this neural network that we created to start them learning what the making of a cupcake was. The output was cupcakes. The beauty, I guess, of what we did, which seemed the sensible and logical thing to do, was get someone who knew how to make a cake. You don't go and say, make this cake. Because you can get, once you've trained it, you will get an infinite number of recipes, right? But the idea is you take what the machine's created. So we haven't got any qualms about saying, well, we don't put the first output because it might be awful. But if we put 500 recipes, let's curate them. And it was just PR for us. Oh, maybe Bristol companies make world's first cupcakes. And they're delicious. We did it to basically put them on our back event. Look at these, you can make cupcakes with AI.
And then
amazing.
People wanted to buy it.
Yeah, and then suddenly people come to us and said, we've been sort of supplied them at festivals and stuff.
What's the flavour though?
So we're doing something for one of the events tomorrow. Somebody who's running it had experienced one of the cakes at something we did maybe a month or so
ago. Experienced a cake.
Well, they're interesting. There's no point in having an AI cupcake if it's a boring flavour. Off the top of my head, there was a banana and bacon.
Oh my god.
But actually, I don't eat meat, so I have no idea what it tastes like. It's also about the exploration of the human maker.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a combo yet? Yes, I think the combination of that, of X and Z together, will work well. Although on paper, it looks a bit daft.
Well, people use maple syrup, don't they?
Salted caramel. You'd have thought that would be a thing. There's one tomorrow that's being served, is wasabi and white chocolate.
Yes, yeah? I can see that.
And that would have been one of, say, maybe 50 recipes we looked at. It's an element of experimentation. But I would say what it kind of serves to do is it allows creators, human creators, to step out of their comfort zone. So we did it with cupcakes. Then we moved on and we found that people would buy these cupcakes. So we could be an AI cupcake company if we wanted to. That's not what we want to do. But as and when people say, oh, could we have some of your cake? Fine. But then we said, well, to be honest, with using a data set of text, if you know how to make something, you could do this with pretty much anything, right? Ice cream, you could do it with storytelling, you could do it with pizzas, you could do it with cocktails. Oh, cocktail, that sounds like a good idea. So we started making AI cocktails. Again, same process. Massive data set of cocktails, got in a really good mixologist, pushed him out of his comfort zone, because at first he was like, well, this is too weird. Exactly the same thing happened. We started making these recipes, put it on, got a lot of interest, traction for it, because cocktails, I don't know, people just get excited about cocktails. And again, it's become, in part for us, a commercial thing, whereby certainly at festivals and maybe corporate events, it's kind of interesting. We've been analysing recently, why do people come to us and ask, because we've had people from all over the world. Come.
Really?
Yeah, it's really weird. You're thinking, why isn't there anybody else doing this? I'm not inviting the world to have a go, but have a go if you want to. It doesn't matter. It's all shared to the universe. We've done some for the Austrian Patent Office. We did a particular interesting data set that was. They wanted it off the flavours of the actual attendees, or the flavour preferences of the attendees. We recently did one for Deloitte in Texas.
Goodness me.
So it's incredible. So we do the data set and the training, we do the curation of the set, we do the work with the mixologist to create them. What we've noticed interesting is that maybe some of the things that we've done is like, oh, wacky AI cocktail. We kind of thought, why has nobody made an AI gin? It's the same principle. If you understand, gin is basically sort of a base spirit with these botanicals in. Juniper has to play a part, but then this whole sort of gin culture has boomed in the last 2 or 3 years, hasn't it? So essentially, all you've got to do is, if we get, again, a data set of as many botanicals, and then train the machine so it starts to predict what it thinks is a great combo, go to a gin maker. So we pitched the idea to a couple, one of which were very keen, and we sort of subsequently sort of moved on. And we're always very suspicious. I can't believe this is the world's first gin, because it seems kind of a, you know, there's many very talented machine learning data scientists in the world and creative technologists, quote unquote, and yet no one seems to have done it. And so we've carried on, and we've got to the point now where today it's been created. But what was brilliant about circumstance, the distillery who got us involved, was they didn't simply want it to be about a combination of interesting botanicals that would make a beautiful gin. They wanted the machine to also do the name, to do the label,
the branding,
yeah, to do everything. The notion was, we created a character for the gin making, which is Jeanette. Haha. And so Jeanette is in effect the neural network, but we kind of personified her. And so we created, it seemed natural to create a Twitter profile for her. There's 1,000 bottles of it. It'll only ever be 1,000 bottles. What it demonstrated, because in effect we trained a Jeanette to understand botanicals. Once it's trained, it's pressed the button. It's just fun to work in these fields.
I want to work for you.
Our rates aren't great, yeah. But we're okay. We've got a plan.
I like how you just did not sell yourself. Just like, our rates aren't great. Don't come for us. It's fine.
We're smart. Well, who knows? Who knows where we'll go?
Before your 2016 epiphany,
yeah,
would you have considered yourself a fairly traditional creative in terms of the way you approached advertising and?
The success of an idea is based on delivering it on the right platform, right? You shouldn't just do something because that's the thing
but
to
I
do.
Suppose my question is, because of that, is how has it changed you in terms of how you think creatively?
Yeah, well,
what's it added to your armoury?
Okay, that's a good question. I think going back to the point, I wouldn't say I am any kind of techie or coder. I was born slightly before, funny enough, or grew up when sort of BBC and ZX Spectrums, all that. I slightly missed it. Right? I do remember playing Space Invaders, you'd be very excited about gaming like that. But it never then led to me becoming a sort of a gamer on Sega or Nintendo or anything like that at all. I've kind of experienced that precariously to my own children. When social media, I'd say about that time, 2006, 2007, when it kicked off, I went to Australia actually for a few years and worked a lot of experience in television. Because that's kind of the prime advertising tool in the creative industry in Australia. Came back, and I ended up getting a job at a direct marketing agency, which was very traditional, wasn't it? Long form copy, emails, and sort of stuff. And I was thinking, well, I don't want to stick this. And then social media turned up in those kind of innocent, wild days where anything was possible. And suddenly I thought, well, actually, I like this. It's short form. Yeah, Twitter's just. It was set up, wasn't it? It's sort of micro blogging,
yeah.
Originally, isn't it? That's
yeah.
what it is.
Yeah.
Short form storytelling, right? If you want a better term. I found, working with my colleague, we also find quite interesting ways to use it. If you find a tool or platform, use it in a way that other people aren't. And to be honest, if I look at where myself, Kerry, and Derek are with Tiny Giant and Creative AI, it's exactly the same. All we've done is we've taken something that people probably use for efficiency, taking large data sets, big data, and making decisions, predictive decisions that make you more efficient. We've gone, why can't we just do it in interesting, creative ways? Whether there's a long-term business future for it, I don't know. But, you know, I always think, have we made our last AI cupcake? And every time I think yes, the phone rings or the, you know, you get an email and so on. So, I don't know. These things do seem to have very long tails.
So it's just made you different in the sense that it's just made you want to be more and more creative every time.
There's a rule, isn't it, called Sturgeon's Law, conceived by a science fiction writer of the 50s and 60s called Theodore Sturgeon. He worked on Twilight Zone, Star Trek, stuff like that. I sound like a techie nerd there, but I just know he was a science fiction writer. And he made this very famous quote, which is subsequently sort of usurped, which was about 90% of science fiction was crap, which is what he said. And then it became Sturgeon's Law was 90% of everything is crap, right? So, and actually, if you apply that to pretty much anything, 90% of advertising is crap.
Sounds like your motto, Robert.
Essentially.
That's what you say about everything.
What you want to strive to be, so therefore you want to strive to be in that 10%. You think about, and if you look at the world around us and you think about the thousands of messages that you either overtly or kind of come into your mind, your eyes, your senses, most of them, it's quite well documented, you don't really notice or you don't respond to. So therefore, people are spending money on this stuff, aren't they?
So do you think this is a golden age because of that?
I don't think it's a golden age of advertising. I think it's an awful age of advertising.
But why is that? If there's such a challenge to cut through that noise and to get people to notice, why hasn't that in itself made it better? Than when, if you put something on during Coronation Street in 1984,
it was
you're getting 20 million and you're done, aren't you? And we look back on those people of a certain age extremely fondly. Whereas now, you would think that those adverts that we all notice really have to be the best you can
advert. I mean, just like the things that pop up on, you know, what they say, the world's biggest protest movement is ad blocking. Mm-hmm. And so, if you think about the nature of digital advertising, what they say now is there's six times as many adverts in the world now than there were 20 years ago. But actually, probably the quality, if you can view it subjectively, has dipped six times, right? So the need of instantaneousness infiltrates everything. Interesting to think, where has that come from? Is that purely through the ability of sort of being told digitally that you can have everything now culturally? So if I can buy what I want now in a couple of clicks, therefore, everything should be now, shouldn't it? And therefore, I need to consume content now. I need to watch my favourite TV show, listen to my favourite podcast. The notion of waiting, now I have no idea, I've got no opinion whether that makes life or society any better or worse. If that's what you enjoy, that's what you know, isn't it? Watching people doing stuff on TikTok,
yeah.
All the way through to, you know, all the opportunities to get what you want in the beat of a heart.
Mm.
This is not the same point, but I remember it from earlier on when you mentioned about Live Aid.
Yeah.
Because I went to see Queen at Wembley the year after that.
Yeah.
And it's funny now that I cannot work out the process by which I knew about the concert, bought tickets for the concert, knew what time it was on. Now it's obvious how that process would happen.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to remember now in 1986.
How did you know that?
How did I know that it was on? When the tickets went on, so I don't remember actually how I even got. I remember there was a postal order involved in the purchase of the tickets. But
postal order?
There was a postal order involved in sending off to get them off, because I was too young for a chequebook.
Yeah.
But I don't even remember how I even knew that
newspapers
concert was
probably.
Even... I suppose it must have.
It must have been. They used to get those coupons in the old days, didn't you?
But maybe there is something in taking things that people have done that people forget about or not used to. We're kind of fairly niche. It's interesting for people because not many people are doing it.
Mm.
There will come a time, maybe, when everyone's doing it. And if so, then we'll be doing something else. Maybe newspaper ads. Ideally.
Moving backwards, but just to talk about the Tech Fest, since the, you know, we
talked about
innovation, this is the first ever one.
Yeah.
How important are events like this for the Southwest in general? Because I feel like we are becoming quite a hub here now, and
nice.
but everything's just so dotted around.
Yeah.
And we need a joined up.
Yeah.
Process.
Oh, I think it's to have this week from the sort of the seedlings of when this was first mentioned a few months back that this could happen. I think it's. It's wonderful to get a concentration. There's loads of meetups that happen on a monthly, quarterly, but they're all over the place, and you have to hunt them down and find them, or you join the thing, you get a newsletter, whatever. But I think to have a sort of concentrated collection, not all these things, the silver thread is obviously technology, but the kind of issues, the stories, the demonstrations, the inspiration, all these things, they're going to be very different. I think it's great to have a focus and a hub in one place where you get that excitement.
A Tech Southwest podcast.
I mean, it's been a really interesting day today. I've thoroughly enjoyed our chats, especially particularly like speaking to Zara Nanu, who was eye-opening about, well, equal pay in general and how technology is making it possible for that to happen, but also the fact that we're still so far behind.
Well, she talked, didn't she, well, about the future and driverless cars and wearable tech, but also at the same time how that made her think we can't let everything lag behind. There's no point having a driverless car if you're being paid 20% less than your male colleague. So I found that aspect of it quite interesting.
Yeah, that we're moving forward in so many different ways, but actually we're staying in the past when it comes to equality, which is absolutely ridiculous. Let's have a little listen in to our chat with Zara Nanu, who is from Gapsware. She's the CEO.
The company was set up about 4 years ago when the World Economic Forum released a report and they said it will be 217 years for the gender pay gap to close globally, and the gender pay gap was at 60%, which meant to every £1 earned by a man, a woman earned about 40p. So at the same time, the World Economic Forum was releasing reports saying that by 2030 we will be in self-driving cars, and by 2030 we'll be sending people off to Mars, and by 2030 hospitals will no longer exist in their current shape and form because a lot of tech will be available at home to care for ourselves. There'll be less accidents on the road because of the self-driving cars, so overall we will be better off. But at the same time, in 2030, when we're in our self-driving cars and waving people off to Mars, we will still somehow be 200 years away from achieving pay parity in work. So we thought, surely that can't be right. And we started exploring the possibility of using the data and the tech that other companies are using to build self-driving cars and to build all the advanced technology, and see how we can use that to facilitate more equality in business.
But why do you think it's happening? Why is there a gender pay gap? Why are we so behind when we're so forward?
One of the key issues is that women do different jobs than men do, so we still have occupational segregation. And the jobs that are dominated by men pay more per hour than the jobs that are dominated by women. So just as an example, you have a data scientist role that would pay around £20 or more an hour, and then you have a legal secretary that will pay living wage per hour, and usually you're more likely to have a man doing a data scientist role and a woman doing a legal secretary. So that is driving a lot of the gap. Then another thing that we see is through the data is that the gender pay gap starts to increase for women by age. So up until the early 30s, the gap's rather small across most jobs. And then it starts accelerating once women hit 30s, and it doubles every decade. So you could have like a 3% pay gap, then the next decade it will be 6, then it will be 12, then it will be 24. So it starts growing quite significantly, and a lot of it could be attributed to the caring responsibilities that women take to care for their children and then take a bit of a step back from their careers. We see actually a bit of a shift in that when companies adopt shared parental leave in its true sense, meaning that they offer benefits to both men and women to take the same benefits, because usually what you have is more benefits for the women and just statutory parental pay for the men, and then it doesn't make financial sense.
Yeah, so the men get 2 weeks off, yeah, or something, and the women get 6 months,
yes,
off paid leave.
But companies that offer shared parental leave and the same benefits across genders actually see more benefits to that in terms of women coming back into employment, retaining those women, men going off and having the same time off as women, and then it's all leveling out. And it's not so bad after that.
Surely that's better for society as well, because then, you know, fathers get to know their children better. And also, well, when you're talking about gay families, for example, what is the situation with them? I mean, that's not fair.
Yeah, so overall, I think we've hit a point where companies are having to rethink these policies, because millennials and generations Y and other letters of the latter letters of the alphabet, they're increasingly interested in sharing caring responsibilities at home. So you have more and more young men interested in taking up caring responsibilities for young children or for older parents, actually having life outside work. We saw a report today from Microsoft that was showing that they moved to a four-day week and actually have seen their productivity increase by 60%. So it's not about how much time you spend at the office, it's about how efficient you are in that time. So companies are having to, all of this is putting a lot of pressure on companies to rethink how they do performance reviews, how they do reward and compensation, and how they view the two genders in the future workplace.
Do you think there's any risk because of the complicated demographic, economic and societal reasons why this gap exists and continues to exist? Do you think there's any risk at looking at gender individually as just its own metric without understanding the complexities that are around it, that actually, so it's not as simple as we're paying a man this and a woman this. So there is an additional layer of complexity.
Absolutely, and this is why, so at Gap Square, initially when we started our piece of software, we went on the market and looking at the requirements that the government has for UK companies to report on their gender pay gap. And companies only have to report on certain gender metrics around pay and around bonuses, and that's about it. But it leaves out a lot of the complexities and a lot of the underlining issues that actually lead to those gaps. So we're just showing the symptoms, but not actually not at all exploring the root causes. So we've developed our software to actually bring together payroll and HR data and help companies understand those complexities, understand what the root causes of the gaps are, so that when they take decisions about policies or they take decisions about pay, they can be informed decisions that will lead to accelerating that progress and narrowing the gap and getting more diverse people into different roles and just overall increasing their appeal to younger generations as a company by doing so.
And so are they very open to these suggestions when you make them, because they want to attract a younger demographic? Or
we see particularly larger companies with a workforce of over 5,000 employees all understand the benefits of looking into their pay and HR data to understand how all of this works out. Initially, it was so that they can explain the gaps to their employees, because then you're faced with a workforce that's looking at you saying, hang on a second, we have a 40% pay gap, why is the pay gap there? So using those insights to explain the gaps was step one. But now they're increasingly moving into using those insights to actually take decisions.
One of the points that Nick Sturge made to us this morning, he also runs Engine Shed, about Bristol and why Bristol itself is such a hub for this technological innovation, and something that surprised us both when we said, what is it about Bristol that drives this? He said it has such a very strong ethical core, and that people are willing to view that their value, not just in their financial value, but also in terms of their societal value and their sustainable value as well.
Yeah.
Have you found that companies are becoming more open to not just looking at that bottom line on the profit and loss sheet, but thinking more about the other more sustainable aspects of their business?
Absolutely, and I think, so Nick is right in that Bristol is such a hub for companies that are thinking ethically and putting values at the heart of their business and actually thinking beyond profit into purpose and bringing those two together. And I think companies of the future are increasingly going to have to do that, and millennials are bringing that change and that shift of paradigm for us because they want to see purpose. So increasingly, any company that is not going to put purpose at the heart of what they do is going to miss out and is not going to be around in about 50 years at all.
Well, that's a big statement. But one of the other things that we were talking about today was about how to drive more young people into tech, and I think using this sort of sustainable thinking is definitely one way forward. But what is it, would you say, that first of all keeps young people away, but also BAME, black and ethnic minority groups, away from the tech sector? Why
I think not just away from the tech sector, but overall from engaging fully in the economy. And we see that through our software for companies and organizations that have ethnicity data and they run that alongside the gender data, the gaps are significantly higher when you add that extra dimension of ethnicity on it. So it can be 2 or 3 times higher for women of black ethnic minority groups within a company. So that's a big issue to address. I think it's interesting it's an interesting question to explore why they're not in the tech sector. I can mention my own example. When I was doing A-levels, if anyone would have told me that I'd be doing statistical regression models by the time I'm 40, I would have laughed in their face because maths was not for girls. I was due to do a career in social sciences and be the kind of, you know, the kind of the softer approach and qualitative approach to policy and to data. And here I am now, realizing that actually data and tech is where money is and where decision making is. And if women are not part of this world, then we're going to miss out significantly. A lot of this tech is currently being developed by white middle-aged Californians. And if we don't jump in there and take control and hold of how that gets developed, we're going to have tools and products and services that don't work for women at all.
Yeah, well, so, like we do right now.
Yes, through our software, we actually see how companies can understand where exactly the gaps in tech are for their populations and look at how long-term and more strategically they can attract young people in there that are of diverse groups, that are of different genders and come from different backgrounds.
How did you get into it? How did you decide actually not going the qualitative route? Studying data.
So I've done kind of the social sciences, and I got a PhD in political science, and I worked for a lot of charities in the kind of the women's rights space. And the thing that never quite sat right with me is how we're working here in the charity sector around women's rights and empowering women, but then you have the private sector going with business as usual on a parallel track without taking stock of any of the things that are emerging from the empowerment work. And actually, without money, you can't really have full power, because money is integral to having power. So that's how I started to think, how can we bring the values from the charity and the women's rights sector into business in a language that is accessible to business, in a language that appeals to business, and business can actually take decisions that will facilitate that economic participation for different groups, for women, for BME groups, for everyone.
Well, I suppose ultimately the difference in saying to a CEO, it wouldn't be nicer and fairer if we pay people the same, as opposed to saying, and here's the data as to why we
yes.
should. That's maybe what has been lacking then previously,
yes.
is that statistical
yes.
analysis that demonstrates why, yes, it would be nice, wouldn't yeah. it? But look at what yeah. it actually does
absolutely
for your bottom line.
Yeah. And the interesting thing was, there was an article in Wired magazine a couple of weeks ago about Mark Benioff, who's the CEO of Salesforce, and he was approached by two female executives who said, we believe there's unfair pay and equal pay in Salesforce. And so he commissioned an audit to see how much people are being paid, and they saw that they have a gap of $3 million. So he convinced the board, they got the $3 million in, they leveled it out, and then a year later, when they looked at pay again, and he was hoping that this time it's going to be zero, because we put $3 million last year, they were missing $1
million. Wow.
Because within that 1 year, the shift of workforce that has happened in terms of different movements into different roles, recruitment of new people, has generated that gap again. And so it highlighted the need to actually look at data, and not just look at data once a year and once every other year, but actually look at data every month if they want to keep track of that. And as rewards, we see companies report increased performance, increased productivity. There's also increased share price growth for companies that have more women in leadership roles or more BAME people in leadership roles.
It just feels like automated pay is a no-brainer, and I don't understand why it's not happening. It doesn't make any sense.
Do you think it's the fallibility of humans, unfortunately, that actually taking that decision-making away from people and giving it to technology, counterintuitive, we may actually make it more fair?
Yes.
That was a much longer question.
A Tech Southwest podcast. You can get in touch with us by tweeting TechSWOfficial.
So the challenge of attracting young people into the tech industry and widening out the impact of the growth of this sector across the whole community was a bit of a recurring theme, wasn't it, today?
Yeah, we spoke to quite a few people about that today, and it seems that the reasons young people don't want to come into the tech sector is because they see it as this incredible industry that's, well, probably shrouded in mathematics and data analytics, and actually that's not always the case.
Well, it's one of the points.
Zara made, isn't it, as well, when she was talking about she never ever would have seen herself working in statistical data analytics.
Yeah.
But if you'd said to her, do you want to help empower women, then she would have said yes, and this just ended up being the way that she did it. And that the use of language around that is obviously really quite key. So Set Squared, and you're quite aware of them when you come into Engine Shed. Their profile here is quite high because it's where they're based, and it's a big collaboration between everybody from Bristol City Council and the university here and other universities. They have created dozens of innovative companies worth billions of pounds and thousands of jobs, and they're trying to make sure that that impacts on the local community too. And Paul Forster told us about some of the work he was doing in trying to make sure that there was a much more joined up emphasis and attitude towards getting people to understand this part of the industry.
I am the community manager at Set Squared Bristol. So Set Squared Bristol is part of the Set Squared Partnership, which is currently the global number one university business incubator. So we provide bespoke holistic business support to tech companies and have been doing so for 17 years. We have an amazing network of people and a really pivotal program, and we grow businesses. So a lot of my role is based around helping our companies, so I need to understand all their background, skills and roadmaps. I do a lot of program curation and design based around their needs, and I also do a lot of signposting, do a lot of relationship building, partnerships and stakeholder engagement, and what can actually be beneficial to our companies, but also how we can give back to the community and do more of a kind of CSR piece. But now we've got a massive focus on diversity and inclusion. And so we've just launched our Back Her Business program, partnering with NatWest and Crowdfund before. And later next year, we'll be relaunching our Breakthrough Bursary, specifically to encourage more applications from Black, Asian, minority ethnic tech entrepreneurs.
How easy is it to do that? I mean, what's stopping BAME communities being in tech?
It's a really good question. So we wanted to ask this question, not answer it ourselves. We were fortunately given some funding by the University of Bristol in 2017 to do a piece of research on what the barriers are that Black, Asian, minority ethnic people actually face accessing support from Set Squared, but also accessing business support on a local level in general. Because obviously not everybody is a tech entrepreneur. All the recommendations from that research have actually been enacted and built into our program. So from our perspective, we've changed the way that we market Set Squared, we've done a marketing audit, and we've updated all of our internal and external comms. As I've already mentioned, we've launched the Breakthrough Bursary, which means that we have three partially funded places to be Set Squared members for a year for BAME Tech Entrepreneurial Talent.
Without making too much of a sweeping generalisation, mm-hmm. for most young people, technology is embedded in their lives.
Yeah,
they've grown up with it, they use it, it's second nature to them, and you can't really explain to people what life was like before a thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
Where then do you think the disconnect appears between knowing that that's part of your life to not seeing it as something that you might actually be able to do?
It starts with education, really, more than anything else. Tech seems like a very foreign or glamorous work to be in. And I'm not sure that we've educated our workforce as well as we could have done over the past 20 years, knowing that this kind of tech boom was coming. However, I can see that a lot of different ways in are coming now. So if you're a young person and you're possibly unlikely to go to university, that doesn't mean you can't have a career in tech. I think it's also important to understand that it's not just about being technical in tech. There's loads of soft skills that you need to work with in the tech industry. And one of the things that I know that Engine Shed do really well is they have the Diverse Workforce for the Future initiative. And so they bring in young people, normally between, I think, 7 and 13, to speak to Set Squared members, to speak to members of the tech business community, and learn about how you can work in a different space that isn't, for instance, a factory or a shop.
So how much of that, then, are you able to inform by the knowledge and the research that's being done around the future workforce and around those future skills, and how that can start to feed into the way that schools as well think about their much more non-traditional pathways? Because I suppose you must still encounter the fact that it is still GCSEs, A-levels, university is still the accepted norm, and you're having to break into that bit, aren't you, and explain how the world is changing really quickly, and how are you going to be ready for that? Is it a challenge to start changing the conversations around that?
I mean, I think the conversations are already being changed, but if you speak to anybody in the industry, then they probably tell you that there is not enough tech talent around, or there's not enough sort of mid-level tech talent around. So cities, countries are trying to attract people in that have got that kind of tech talent. There's lots of organizations that will do 12-week programs that get people coding, which is great. But I think, actually, there's a massive skills gap. It's not something that can be plugged quickly. When it comes to the conversations with schools and colleges, they can only work within the boundaries of their curriculum.
Thank you for listening to the podcast in collaboration with Stephen Scone. It's been absolutely wonderful. The first one here at Bristol Tech Fest. I feel like we're really at the hub of something.
Yeah, it's not bad for the first episode, is it? I mean, I feel like I've learned an awful lot. Want to come back, want to spend some more time in Bristol.
We definitely want to spend some more time in Bristol, and I can't wait to see what's next for the tech sector. Our next podcast is going to be very interesting because we're going to be at the Tech Southwest Awards.
Yeah, we're here from everybody.
The movers and shakers in tech world.
Yeah, we've just had a bit of a good introduction to it today. Now we could spend a little bit of time celebrating the winners, the Oscars of tech in the Southwest.
It's going to be very interesting. So we look forward to you guys listening to us wherever you listen to your podcast. We're all going to be on Spotify, iTunes, and maybe you're also listening on our website. Either way, thank you so much for being part of this. See you next time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
A Tech Southwest podcast in collaboration with Stephen Scone. You can get in touch with us by tweeting @TechSWOfficial.